On the night of October 4th of 1967, shortly after 11 o'clock p.m., a UFO some 60 feet in diameter was seen to hover over the water near the tiny fishing village of Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia. The UFO, which displayed four bright lights that flashed in sequence, tilted to a 45-degree angle and descended rapidly towards the water's surface. Upon impact, there was a bright flash, an explosive roar. Concerned witnesses began calling the nearby police departments. None of those witnesses mentioned anything about a UFO. Most believe that a large aircraft had ditched into the harbor and that there might be survivors. In a moment, this is just one of the stories we'll talk about on Coast to Coast with our guest tonight, Joe Montaldo, on Coast to Coast AM. Joe Montaldo is founder and national director of the International Community for Alien Research, ICAR, has close to 7,000 abduction cases on file. He has been a researcher investigator of alien contact, abductions, and experiencers for more than 20 years. He is the owner of a paranormal radio and the host of Wake Up USA, a UFO study talk show. He's also a board member representing contactees for Dr. Michael Sala's Exopolitics Institute. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Joe, welcome to the show. How are you?
Very good, George. Thanks for having me on tonight, man.
Pleasure.
I appreciate it.
But tell me a little bit about ICAR and how was it formed?
Actually, the International Community for Alien Research was actually founded right about nine and a half years ago. And what happened was I was working with MUFON, with our local state director down here out of Louisiana, and we were accumulating a lot of data, but we weren't getting any real responses from anyone, and the data wasn't being put together coherently. In other words, it was just cases spread all over the place, and no one really was getting any use out of them. So I got with a few investigators from them, along with some people I had met over the years in the field. We sat down and we compiled about 5,000 cases, went through them, and we got what we call abduction criteria from them. At that point, we realized there was a real need for an organization that specialized in abduction research. So we just kind of branched off from that point with MUFON. There was about five of us that co-founded the organization. There's about 3,800 of us now, give or take one or two. And the organization has been making leaps and bounds in abduction research. I mean, that's what we do. We specialize in finding the connections between abduction cases and seeing what we can find. Basically, what we're looking for is, like, if someone tells us, well, I saw a gray alien, well, that's fine, it's gray, but I'm more interested in, does it have eyes? What color are the eyes?
Exactly.
Does it have pupils? Things like that. And we've gotten down to fingernails, interiors of ships. Do they wear clothes? Do they not wear clothes? You know, do they have ears? I mean, just little things, but it's little things that when you go through 7,000 cases and you see them, and by the way, the 7,000 cases is what we consider legitimate abductions. That's not how many cases we've actually gone.
You've got to weed those out, don't you?
Yeah, and that's the exact thing, George. It took 25 years to get to where we are, and it'll probably take another 25 years to double our research. But the thing of it is we do have some basic understandings now. We do understand certain things that are going to happen in specific age groups and specific type of contactees with specific type of aliens.
Are you seeing a pattern, Joe, with this?
Yes, actually, we see several patterns. I don't want to jump ahead of ourselves here, but you know, people ask me about the alien agenda all the time. Well, when you have this many cases, you can actually see a direction. You can see a movement, and you can see things that are. In other words, we'll even tell contactees now when they first join the group. We'll say, "Well, look, you know, you're in your early 20s. You can expect this, and this over the next 10 years," and it helps prepare them for what's coming, and it really gives us. And I've noticed the younger you accept this, the more data you can accumulate. I don't know if it's a trust thing with the aliens or not, and I hate to say that, but I think they'll let you know as much as they feel you can handle.
And is there anything that these people, when you tell them you can expect this in the next 10 years,
mm-hmm.
is there anything that they can do to stop it, to prevent it?
You know, we've tried many, many things. You know, we test contactees to see if they have psychic abilities, as much as you can test this ability, by the way. But one of the things we have tried, and we've tried this in groups, is what they call group protection, where you have four, five, six contactees that are fairly psychic. And what I mean is they're fairly telepathic is what they are, not clairvoyant or empathic, but they're just telepath. And we try to stop it through that. Now, I can tell you there's been limited success. And as far as we can tell, there's even been repercussions for doing it. As far as actually stopping an abduction, we haven't been able to do it. And to my record, the only person I know that said he could was Daryl Sims, and we still disagree on that,
right,
by the way.
Right.
But it doesn't seem, you know, people tell me all the time, well, I invoke the name of Christ, or I do this, or I do that, or I do this, and it stops. I said, well, okay, can we bring you in for therapy? Can we have someone sit and speak to you? Would you mind being regressed? Because we'd like to know if it has really stopped. And I noticed in about 90% of those cases, it hasn't stopped. They just took the memory away from the individual because, frankly, they can't handle it.
Even though we're going to get into some specific cases here tonight, Joe, and, mm-hmm. and the agenda, I am really fascinated when you mentioned what they look like in the inside of the craft. And I assume what you're getting is similarities of for data. You know, if you get 1,000 people who all say the same thing, you got to start saying to yourself, you know, this could be a craft or crafts that are coming from the same system, probably.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we're finding. Like, you hear the typical Hollywood version of the gray. It's a 3-foot gray, big head, black eye.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to tell you what we have, and I'm bordering getting myself in trouble with abduction criteria here, but basically the grays, to start off with, the drone grays and the 4-foot grays, or a bluish, grayish color. Okay, and it's one of the things we ask contactees because we're looking for this specific blue color. Because if you're not telling us this, more than likely the experience isn't true because it's in too many cases.
So you've heard it too many times, yeah.
And so, you know, we know that this is a specific thing to this type of alien. We also know that the 3-foot guys are probably not 100% sentient or 100% real. There may be some, I don't want to call them automaton, maybe an advanced android. There seems to be a symbiosis there, though, between some type of living and controlled being at the same time.
Sure.
Once you hit the 4-foot ones, which basically don't look all that much different than the little automatons, but those are pretty much the guys who are running everything. They're not the bosses, but they're the guys who are taking care of the contactees or the abductees or the children they have on board. They're the ones who are going to recruit the keepers, which are the humans that help with these contacts. And these are usually people 30 to 50 years old who have come to terms with their contact and are willing to, I don't want to say work with the aliens, more like work with their fellow brethren, you know, because they know if they can help these people doing this contact, it makes it much, much easier.
Yeah, they're comfortable.
Yeah, and we didn't find this out until about 10 years ago that they were recruiting people for this. And the way we found it out is we started having a group of contactees in their mid-50s where their experience had changed totally. There was no more truce of anything. The aliens seemed to be working with them quite readily and quite coherently. And they started using these people to help with the children, help with the contactees being brought on board, things like that. And it just came out. And now that we've actually been looking, we've been finding a lot more. And this is another weird thing, too. For years and years and years, even myself, I thought the female-to-male ratio for contactees was 70-30. In the last 2 years, we've had, for every one female, we've had 5 males come forward. So I'm not exactly sure what that's about.
Strange, yeah.
And I'm figuring it's more like 60, 40, something like
but
that.
But you're saying, Joe, that there are some human beings on this planet who have some kind of working relationship with the alien agenda, and they're acting as helpers or as go-betweens?
Yeah, they basically, these are contactees or abductees, whatever you'd like to refer to them. Well, they're contactees for sure, but that have reached the plateau where they no longer have the fear that they had.
Are they quiet? I mean, they're obviously not blabbing this around this planet, telling people who they are and what they're doing.
No, they're not. And until just recently, none of them had spoke publicly. I got one of them to speak publicly recently, and the thing of it is, it makes them really nervous. Matter of fact, I was told by a couple of them when they heard I was coming on your show that they would appreciate it if I didn't mention the name. I said, well, I'm not going to mention anybody's name, but
right.
I'm going to talk about the keeper thing because these are just ordinary people, by the way. It's not military or industrial or anything like that. Some of them may be. I don't know. But it seems to be that when a contactee reaches a certain plateau, they introduce this to them. It's like a choice.
Are they the helpers here, the keepers? Are they regional in that they don't travel a lot, but they just work within a certain area?
Well, you know, that's a good question because you know, we do a lot of research out of Gulf Breeze, Florida. And we found a keeper that pretty much, there's about three of them that I would have to say they would manage from about the Louisiana-Texas state line to the upper part of Florida, maybe as high as Arkansas. But the face, and this is what's really interesting, I will get people who will describe these individuals that they see that are kind of guiding them or walking with them or holding their hand. And what's interesting is I've met these individuals, these people who said they were keepers. The pictures are identical. And it's just really, really freaky weird. Sorry for the lack of definition there, but it the first time I seen someone draw a picture of someone who told me they were a keeper who I knew was a contactee, it was...
Are you saying that all the keepers look alike?
No, no, they're all individual people, but it seems to be that particular groups of contactees are involved with particular keepers. And it seems to be locally specific to those groups, even though it may cover, you know, five or six states.
Now, do these keepers have families? Do they have normal jobs?
Yeah, they're just everyday people. I mean, it could be your husband, your wife, your brother, your sister, your uncle.
All right, but they...
it's just someone who has reached a plateau level that, and it's a willing participant, by the way. It's not a forced. It's willing. These people have reached a level with their experience where they're willing to take the next step.
All right. Now, And they're generally quiet about this.
Yeah, they generally are very quiet about this. And I don't know if, you know, somebody asked me the other day, was it an ashamed thing? I don't think that's what it is. I think that these people are just worried that, you know, people would look at them as sympathizers. Yeah, because not everybody's real happy that they're having contact.
Well, that's a good point.
And, and that's the thing. I mean, for us, we look at, three levels of contact. But you know, a good contact, a bad contact, and something that falls in between, because there is all three. But what would you define as a bad contact, George?
I don't think there are bad contacts. If they're contacts, they're contacts.
That's what I'm saying. So, you know, for us, it's hard. If you know someone's being picked up and certain intrusive things are being done to them, you want to be mad about it. I mean, it's human nature. Somebody's violating you in a way, you want to be mad. But a lot of these contactees, after a while, they just kind of look at it much differently.
Well, they feel safe, I guess, and that's a big, big relief, isn't it?
They feel safe. I don't know. But there's something else we've noticed, too. Contactees in general kind of distance themselves from the rest of the population. They kind of distance isn't the right word. They're very... contactees in general are very outgoing
type
of people.
More standoffish, maybe?
Yeah, but it's almost like, let's say that you know a contactee, and you're not a contactee, but you're a really close friend. You'll start to see like almost a shield going up between them, like they know they're protecting themselves. And I'm not sure from what. That kind of scares me a little bit, to be honest with you. Because we've noticed that just in the last 5 years. That there seems to be contactees in general seem to be getting a little bit standoffish from the general population.
Is it because, Joe, they may know something? Maybe some event is about to occur and they're afraid they're going to leak it or something like that?
See, that's what worries me. The data suggesting that at least one type of these aliens, or maybe two for sure, seem to have an agenda. Well, let's just say it's not overly friendly for everyone on the planet.
Well, David Jacobs would say the same thing, you know.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, last year at Laughlin, David and I talked about this for about 3 hours. Him and I, and Bud, we had a big old crowd going around the table.
anybody in black suits watching you?
You know, it's funny. I don't see things like that anymore. We have been, we like to call them the men in gray. They're driving white SUVs with black tinted windows with false government plates on it, and they dress in what looks to be it looks like an Armani suit, but it's gray.
Yeah.
And we've seen them on a couple occasions. I had them come to a job site out here in New Orleans and tell me when I first took over Wake Up USA, they came out to tell me that, look, we don't mind you talking about specific things, but why don't you kind of stay off the alien agenda for a while? This was in front of a whole crew I had working on the roof. Yeah, there was 26 guys that day out there working on this property with me? And they had no qualms about coming right up and letting everybody see them.
And then off they went.
And I noticed, and this was weird, and you can ask Alfred Weber about this, we got onto the alien agenda one night, and every 15 minutes, his phone line would go down, my phone line would go down. We'd come back, and we'd start on right where we left off, 15 minutes, both lines were down. And I don't know, you know, I hate to get into conspiracy stuff because I'm really not big on it, but it was definitely strange, George. It was just strange the way it was going on. Even Alfred was kind of like, he wrote me a letter a couple of days later. He said, what was going on? I'm like, apparently they didn't want us talking about that.
Well, this keeper story is incredible. Do these keepers, do they go along with the abduction when it occurs? I mean, are they there?
In a lot of cases, they are. They are present, especially with known problem contactees or abductees. In other words, people who resist or fight, a lot of times you'll see these keepers there. And it's because they have a calming effect. You know, these are men and women, usually 40, 50 years old.
Human beings.
Human beings that have gone through this themselves, and they're sitting there telling you, hey, look, I'm still here.
Yeah.
I made it.
Calm down. I live in Wisconsin or whatever.
Yeah, because, you know, I was talking with Jim Sparks about this, and, you know, he kind of understands this from a contactee's point of view. And he's like, you know, I do remember this. And we actually talked about that quite a lot. And it was one of those strange things because when we first learned about it, it was kind of like, well, these are the people we need to talk to. These are the people with the information. These aren't the ones we're going to learn about procedures and ships, but we're going to learn what the aliens may or may not be doing. One of the things we started doing, George, is we started training people to telepathically ask questions, reflectively ask questions without thinking about it. You know, we'll put in questions, what are your intentions? Just stuff like that.
Right.
And now what we're doing, because we're affiliated with so many contactees, is even the aliens are kind of getting bombarded by it. So, you get a lot of comparative information back. About 60% of the time, you'll get a contactee, you'll come back and talk about something they may or may not have seen, or something the aliens imaged to them dealing with, what may be coming in the near future. Of course, that's another thing. What's near future to us may be 300 years for them.
I hope so. Now, will you describe these extraterrestrials, I'll call them that for a moment, as bluish-gray? What else did they look like?
Well, what's funny is, and this is, I'm going to catch some stuff for this one. You know, they do have an almond-shaped eye, and there is a black shield, but the thing of it is a shield. It is not an eye. Underneath that is an eye about 1.5 times the size of the eye, usually in a yellow to an amber color with a slightly oblong-shaped pupil.
Does it look reptilian?
I wouldn't call it reptilian. I would call it, almost more cat-like than reptilian.
Okay, okay.
And
the shield is what, like a sunglass or something? Like...
Yeah, there's something to do, and I've got a couple of mixed reviews on this, but it seems like there's something, and at first I thought it was like sunglasses, but
yeah.
They wear them at night, so it can't be sunglasses.
Well, I don't know. A lot of people here wear sunglasses.
Well, that's true, too, and I'm guilty of that one myself, but it seems to act more like a filter. There may be, maybe it's the pollution in our atmosphere, but there seems to be an irritant, and I think that's why they're wearing them, because even on the ship sometimes they have them on.
That is interesting. Okay, and they just pop right into their eye socket?
Yeah, they must just, I think somebody said something about molecular bonding. I'm not an engineer, so I'm not sure. But they said somehow or another, it's like a glue that bonds itself to the surface of the skin, and then they can just push it a certain way, and it just pops off.
Do they wear clothes, uniforms?
Some do, some don't, which I found interesting in itself. It's
Well, I guess if they're androids or robots, they wouldn't need it, would they?
No.
Stay with us, Joe. We're going to be right back. We'll get into some of these episodes like Shag Harbor and the Barney and Betty Hill case and some of those others, but I still want to find out more about some of these keepers. That's fascinating. First time I ever heard about that. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Joe Montaldo. He's a researcher, founder of the International Community for Alien Research. Joe, later on, tell us a little bit about how people can hear you on paranormal radio, okay?
Okay.
And some of the things you do. How do the abductees, Joe, describe the inside of these crafts?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, well, let's pick a species here, and we'll just say the grays for sake of argument. Generally, what you're going to get from, like, say, a young abductee, say, between ages 13 and age 28, is you're going to usually get a room that's full of light, that seems to be seamless, with a reflective floor, and there doesn't seem to be any instrumentation or any type of tables present. And that's mainly because the positions they're in, they really don't get to see much, and they're not really remembered much. Now, when you break up to the next phase of awakening, which starts around age 30, These contactees are giving you much more details. The room that the first, what they're describing when they're younger is, it's an oval-shaped room. It's more like it's kind of like a double-sided diamond. Because when you're looking, you can actually see through the floor translucently down several decks, from what I understand. Just as it's going down, it's almost like the center of the ship itself is translucent from top to bottom. Also, the walls are seamless. There doesn't seem to be any type of doors at all on these craft. It's either there's an open hallway, an open doorway, or as you approach it, the skin of the ship itself adjusts for the person moving in and out of it. It doesn't actually move away. You can actually physically pass in and out of it, which I really found to be fascinating. It's no technologies we have, that's for sure.
Yeah, really.
But, you know, they're not on the gray ship, you will never hear anybody describe any physical instrumentation, one of the problems I've had with Roswell, by the way. You will hear them describe things like that connect to your head, connect to your wrist, things that will read different rhythms in the body, things like the teacher where they put this thing on your head. And they coined the word from the teacher, by the way, from some Star Trek episode. But basically, what is it? The learning machine. And it's helping you to learn their language. And what I mean by their language is each contactee has a specific language back towards their keeper, which is a gray. That's a whole other thing in itself. But it goes back specifically to them. It also helps them develop their telepathic abilities, things like that. It helps them to understand what the grays are doing here, what the program's about, what the breeding program's about, what the hybrid program's about. Things like that. But you don't see any buttons, any switches, any flips, any dials, anything like that. We're not getting these descriptions. Basically, the gray ship is described very clean inside, very sleek. The walls themselves, or they say that when you touch them, the ship responds to your touch. Like the skin of the ship itself is alive in some fashion or form.
I wonder, Joe, if where they are is the inside of something that's inside something bigger. So they don't see the machinery in the command post and the things necessary to keep this ship moving. Maybe they are just in this enclosed area in the middle or something.
Well, I'm sure some of them are, because we do have this. Well, the gray ships are described very strange. This is another abduction criteria, blue plasma, which is seen by pretty much all gray contactees. It's what the grays eat. They absorb it through their skin. I can literally tell you, I've had 3,000 plus contactees tell me this. They also immerse humans in this stuff to help revitalize them and to give them, I guess, energy, things like that. They also say this stuff feeds the ship's power supply, which I find interesting, and it's self-replicating. It's almost sentient in a form. It's alive. The plasma itself is definitely alive, and they say it's used for several things, but the gray ships are supposed to be almost mechanically. It's like the ship itself can change its skin layers. It can change its structure to manipulate what it needs at the time.
The ship is a shapeshifter all by itself.
Well, yeah, basically that's what they're describing, because they can say that a lot of contactees will say it looks like a saucer as it's approaching, you know, landing. But when it's up and getting ready to go, it like stretches into an elongated saucer. And then it just simply disappears. So it's actually changing shape. So I'm assuming, which is a big assumption, that when it's stretching itself out like that, that must be when you're going to find anything dealing with any kind of hard mechanical stuff or engines and stuff like that. But, you know, no one really understands their technology as far as I know. Now, you see, when they describe the reptilians and the humans, they describe a much more physical-type technology, more like inside of like an aircraft carrier or something. They're describing it in a much more lower sophisticated technology than what the grays have.
How do people know, Joe, how do they really know if they've been abducted? Are they having bad dreams? Do they stumble into some hypnosis? How do they know?
Well, I'll be honest with you. When someone comes up and says, hey, I'm an abductee, I'm like, okay, nice to meet you. Usually, it's not something you're going to realize right away. It usually does manifest itself first in dream form, and usually it'll start having a physical manifestation after that. The way you're going to know is you're going to come to a point where nothing else is going to explain the things that are happening to you. Nothing. You can go to, and we tell people all the time, we refer people to psychologists, we send them to doctors, because, you know, people will call us and tell us, they have these weird things going on in life. Well, we'll tell them, you know, go get a CAT scan done. Go get pretty much a complete physical.
Get the medical thing taken care of first.
After that's out the way, we will have them meet with a psychologist, talk with a psychologist, work with them. Because a lot of times you can bring out stuff just by talking to a psychologist. And to be honest with you, George, probably one out of every 10 people who come in actually turn out to be a contactee. And you'll be surprised at some of the stuff like molestation and all that people cover up as an abduction. And we run into that a lot, but, you know, we have to go through them. But the thing of it is that's what it comes down to. When you can simply rule away every other thing that it can be, and that's, you know, stuff like sleep paralysis, things like that. Once you can rule all this out and it's not a, you know, a dream or an illusion or some kind of drug-induced something or another, then you can move on from that point. And I notice with most people, it's almost like a relief. When they finally realize that this is a real phenomenon and this is something real going on in their lives change overnight. These people become much more stable, much more reliable, much more goal-orientated. So, you know, it's one of the reasons we have an online support group, because we find people all the time that are dealing with this and don't have anybody to talk to about it. You know, and it's rough. I mean, if you're a contactee, I mean, you don't want to go tell your husband or your son or your coworker, hey, look, aliens are picking you up, because they're going to look at you like you lost your mind.
All right. What about children? Are children getting abducted?
Well, that's an interesting thing, because for us to be a true abductee or a true contactee, you have to be lifelong. See, for like Travis Walton, we consider Travis Walton to have been abducted, but not to be an abductee or a contactee.
Right, right.
And for us, it starts before birth in the mother's womb. Your first abduction is when they pick up your mother and or testing her while she's pregnant with you. The first memories usually show around age 4 or 5, and then they'll change and vary. What I find interesting is kids, 4 and 5, 6 years old, regardless what type of alien you're talking about, usually like them. So that's interesting in itself. But at puberty, the types of experiments they run with the kids become much more aggressive from about, from, you know, 13, 11, 12, 13 to about 25, 26, 27. They're running a much more aggressive routine on these people. And if you're inexperienced in this, yeah, you think these guys are pretty bad and not real nice, and you really don't want to know these people. After that, though, at age 30, around age 30, age 28, the experiences change again into a much different type of abduction. They're usually more, it's more like what Jim Sparks was talking about. It's more knowledge-orientated, behavior-orientated, things like that. They're not really performing biological experiments anymore. A lot of times they are introducing you to children. And that's something else, like when I was telling you earlier about all these men coming forward. A lot more men are coming forward and telling us about meeting their children on these ships. And it's starting to kind of bother me now, because with as many people who we're talking to, when you start thinking, if it's 2% of the population or 10% of the population, you know, you're talking 400 or 500 million people that are being contacted. And if you start thinking each one of them have 2, 3, 4 hybrid children, you've got a population of 2 billion sitting somewhere.
That's right.
And for me, it's more about, first off, why are they doing this? What are their plans for us? And is there any long-term plans for this planet? I mean, is someone planning on colonizing this place and letting part of us stay and getting rid of it and making room for somebody else?
Or saving us?
Or saving us. And in a way, George, I think they are saving at least a slice of the population. I don't want to say they're saving everybody on Earth, because I would be lying to everybody, but it does seem that they've isolated a particular segment of the population, and it does seem that they abduct in family lines for long lines of generation. Right now, we're working several cases where there's 5 generations or more of contact in the same family.
And it's done quietly.
It's done very quietly. And most, well, George, I mean, if ET came to your house, well, you might be different because you host radio, but most people that are career, you know, have a career, especially a high-paying career, aren't going to say this. They're just not going to. And what I think most people miss is about 80% of contactees are high IQ'd and very good positions in their life, and are usually holding positions of either power inside of companies or things along those lines. And, well, that's probably more about 60%. But, you know, on average, when you test the contactee, their IQ is almost always over 140.
Now, was it high before the abduction or after?
Well, you see, that's the thing. We don't know because we don't know when the first abduction in that family was. You know, as far as we know, it may have started back with the Sumerians or even further than that. So we don't know when this significant change happened. I mean, is this from, you know, current abductions, or this was from your mother's abductions or your grandmother or your great-grandmother? There's just no way for us to tell. In some family lines, we have been lucky, like as a family out of Boston. They've actually had their IQ tested for the last five decades, I'm sorry.
Are you concerned, Joe, and other members of your organization with these abductions?
Well, it's the reason I got involved. Well, the thing of it is, the first time somebody told me they were abducted by aliens, I looked at them and said, you need to seek professional help. I really did. I'm not even going to lie to you about it. And after about 10 people told me this, I started looking into it. And the more I looked into it, the more it troubled me. Because first off, even for my friends out there, and I know y'all are listening, that tell me they have benevolent, really nice contacts, you know, and everything's sweet and loving and peaceful and clean. Like I told them, they're still abducting you. They're not asking your permission to take you from your house or your car or your job. They're just doing it. Regardless how they treat you when they get you there, they are not calling you on the phone and saying, hey, David, can I come pick you up and take you for a ride? No, you know, they're not doing that. You know, they're just going on their merry way, picking you up, doing what they want and dropping you off. And from what we understand about what they can do with your memory, we don't even know how much of this is real and how much of this is planted. And to be honest with you, George, I don't think ET's beyond lying to us.
Well, you know, even if, let's say of the 7,000 cases that you've studied, even if one of them is real, one of them,
yeah,
it's significant.
It is. And it's, you know, we talk about disclosure all the time, and I think people miss the point on disclosure. And I do give Dr. Greer a hard time about it all the time. But, you know, trying to get the government to disclose anything is a waste of time. I'm not going to lie to you, and it's a waste of good money. George Bush's group and the group that follows him, the group after that, are not going to disclose this. This is a money-making business for them. They're not going to disclose extraterrestrials to this planet. It's going to be people like yourself, myself, and everybody else who's working in these fields or that is willing to put this on the air. That is going to be the disclosure. That is where disclosure is going to come from. That is where the education of our country and the planet is going to come from. And when enough of us finally say, okay, you know what, these guys are right, there's something going on, then you may have a chance of getting disclosure from the government. But I could be wrong.
Well, I don't know. Brazil seems to be softening up. France seems to be softening up, but we're not.
No, and I don't, because we're the ones with the technology. I don't think France or Brazil or any of them have possessed alien technology. I'm not even sure if any like Russia or any of them possess alien technology, but the United States does.
Joe, when we come back, I want to talk with you about Shag Harbor, sure. Barney and Betty Hill, and then Travis Walton. But tell us, in the couple minutes we have left here this hour, tell us what you do with Paranormal Radio. You know, I think it's great that so many people have so many different venues for people who are interested in this, and so you might as well get a plug-in or two.
No, I appreciate it, George. I took over UFO Paranormal Radio Network about 6 months ago. It was acquired through some friends of ours. What we're doing there is we're offering a venue for people who have credible research, okay? We're offering you a venue to come on and put your research on whether you're a famous person or not. It's a place where you can come in and put it on. Right now, the station average is about 500 listeners an hour, so you actually have an audience to talk to. Nothing like coast to coast, mind you guys, but you
hey,
have an audience.
Every little bit helps, Joe.
But it's there. Right now, there's no charge for the services on there. It's commercial free as of now.
Internet radio?
It is internet radio. Okay. Goes out to 56 countries and 226 American cities. So you're getting a good audience there. We do have shows like The Voice of the People that pull about 10,000 listeners an hour. There's some new shows coming on like The Unabridged Universe, which I'll be on March 3rd, by the way, that cover a wide range of topics. And it's there for people so that you can sit and listen and get educated, and you're going to hear a lot of the same guests that you would hear on Coast to Coast or a lot of the other shows that are out there. And then you're going to hear a lot of things that are going to be coming straight from the different people. And also, we do allow, on some occasions, we have two support groups online, but the major one is the UFO Alien Phenomena group for ICAR. That group, we do broadcast over the air from time to time. When we're having an abduction meeting in there and the contactees don't mind, we will air that live. And we will allow people to interact with the contactees so that they can Because, look, guys, I'm going to be honest with you. Anytime I can get a contact you to talk, I'm going to go into, okay? Because that's where the information is. Yeah. These are the people you want to talk to. These are the guys that knows what's going on. And it's really important for everyone to at least listen. You know, I tell people all the time, you don't have to believe that aliens are visiting the planet. All you need to understand it is there is close to 500 million people on this planet that are having an experience that no one at date can explain away. And I said, all I'm asking for is a coherent study done by several of our peers out there, and just let them look at the evidence. I mean, I'm more than willing to let them look at the evidence, but I want them to. And that's one of the things Paranormal Radio is for, is if you have evidence or you have information that's good information, well, you're more than welcome to come visit us. I'll hook you up with one of our interns, and they'll get you on there, and they'll get you on the air, and you can talk with everybody.
How do people find you?
www.paranormalradio.com. That's the easiest way to find us. www.paranormalradio.com. Easy, easy, easy. Or if you can't, you can always go to the icar1.com site. You know, that's an easy address. You know, icar1.com, guys, come on. That's easy. Y'all got to remember that. But it is something that we've been working with. Matter of fact, I have offered, George, a couple of my fellow ufologists airtime on the show. I'm on the network. I'm kind of curious to see which ones are going to take it and which ones aren't. I know most all of them, and I'm quite good friends with quite a few of them, but a lot of them, I think, are more interested in TV these days, to be honest with you.
Well, there's nothing like radio, Joe.
Oh, I love radio.
Nothing like radio.
This is one of my favorite venues, and to me, you can sit, you can talk, you can get the point across. These days, we also, matter of fact, on the Paranormal Radio, we also offer a full duplex interactive environment for a virtual room. So you can set up a virtual room. You can take your 800 calls. You can take virtual calls from the internet. It all ties in real nice and seamless, and it's really great technology. I got to say, that's another thing, George. I love this new technology. You know, because y'all have AM now. Y'all broadcast simulcast too, don't y'all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're all over the place. Joe, stay with us. When we come back, we'll look at the specific case studies, which I'm really fascinated in. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're back with Joe Montaldo, and he heads up an organization called the International Community for Alien Research. Joe, Shag Harbor, an incredible story that occurred in October of 1967. What kind of work have you been doing in that arena?
You know, we started digging on Shag Harbor back about 10 years ago, as much as, because I got to be honest with everyone who's listening to us tonight, Shag Harbor is probably one of the best UFO cases there is, simply for the fact, as I heard George note earlier in the show, there was multiple witnesses to this, and no one reported this as a UFO. Most people thought this was a plane that went down in the harbor. There were several people who went out to investigate it from the weird yellow foams and quite a few other things. But what I found interesting, in the last 3 or 4 years, we've had several people come forward now. Most of this is really hard to confirm, and a lot of this we're still working on confirming.
Okay.
There was a gentleman named Marsh who came forward and said he was one of the divers present when this thing was parked off the coast of Nova Scotia.
And let's review just real quickly, Joe, what happened. October 1967, a UFO about 60 feet in diameter was hovering over the water near this tiny fishing village called Shag Harbor in Nova Scotia. It had four bright lights. It was tilted at a 45-degree angle. It descended rapidly towards the water. We don't know if it went there on purpose or if it was crashing. Upon impact, there was a bright flash. There was an explosive roar. Could have been the propulsion system. Who knows? And let's pick it up from there, then.
And basically, this is what we have. I mean, you had several people go out in boats from different town officials to just everyday Joe walking down the street that happened to see this. Now, when they got out there, no one actually found a craft at the time. They did see something glowing under the water, and they did see the different, which the foam, I've heard the foam described by four or five different people now. They're describing the same foam. For some reason, they describe it with a slightly different smell. Some people say it has a sulfur smell. Some people says it has more of like an electrical smell, like when you burn, like an electrical motor when it's burning up that particular wine smell it has from the windings. But anyway, at that point, this thing had actually left the harbor. It was seen leaving the harbor and headed out to the ocean. Now, to the best of everyone's knowledge, this thing parked off the coast of Nova Scotia for 7 days. This wasn't an isolated thing, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, where it hit the water, stayed there, and then no one ever said anything about it again. This thing actually took off underwater, made its way out to the ocean, up the coast, and parked off the coast of Nova Scotia, where there were several both Canadian and American naval vessels.
It was tracked, wasn't it?
It was tracked. It was tracked by the U.S. Navy and by the Canadian Navy, from what I understand. And the thing about this is significant. And there are several eyewitnesses, both from the Navy and from people standing on shore, that said they seen divers going in the water on a regular basis. Now, the original report I heard 10 years ago said there was two divers present. Now, here we are in 2007, and I'm hearing more along the lines of 20 or 30 divers, which sounds more reasonable to me if you're trying to recover a saucer or a ship that went down. At this point, I don't want to say it was extraterrestrial, but as far as I know, we have nothing that can fly in the sky, go underwater, and I mean, it impacted the water. From the way the witness described this, it impacted the water hard.
That's right. And there were a lot of UFO reports prior to the UFO going into the water.
Well, there was also a brownage reported in, don't hold me to this, I think it was Quebec, Canada, about an hour prior to this thing going down, which was common with the UFOs back then with the power grid for some reason or another. So it just adds more credence to what was going on here. Now, to the best of our knowledge, we have nothing that could impact the water as hard as this thing did and then take off underwater and then stay emerged for 7 days underwater. I just don't think we possess this technology even in today's society, much less we're talking 40 years ago. So I don't think it was ours in any shape, form, or fashion. It's very important because you have witnesses at the impact site. You have witnesses that tracked this thing through the harbor, both people who worked for the service that said they were tracking it with sonar, and eyewitnesses in both that said they could see the glowing object as it was moving along. So you have lots of witnesses from lots of different areas here. Unfortunately, now that the case is getting older, a lot more of these people are dying, but there's still quite a few of them around.
Well, and what we hear, too, is after the ships, now these are like Coast Guard-type ships.
Mm-hmm. Coast Guard.
Sat over the submerged UFO for 1 week, watching it being repaired by yet another craft underwater, the flotilla is ordered to show challenge to a Soviet submarine that apparently decided to violate the 12-mile international limit in attempt to make contact with the underwater UFO. This is incredible, Joe.
It is.
And as this confrontation unfolds, both UFOs then leave the area underwater and move toward the Gulf of Maine, where they break the surface and fly away. This departure gives rise to a second major sighting on 11 October 1967, of two UFOs sighted in that area by multiple witnesses from Shag Harbor to Yarmouth. Isn't that incredible?
It is, and we tell people all the time, you know, people say, well, where's the evidence? I said, apparently you haven't reviewed Shag Harbor. I mean, just look at this case. I can understand if one little fisherman had seen this and one guy had seen it when it came out, okay, we didn't have a case, but there's entirely too many witnesses that are corroborating the same stories that have no relationship to each other in any shape, form, or fashion. And now in the last 2 years, we're starting to have divers come forward and talk about what they've seen. Marsh was telling us that he had seen, he had been sent down to see what was going on, and he was talking about the second craft when he seen what appeared to be a gray swimming without any equipment at all, approaching the other ship, which just blew my mind when I heard that.
Can you imagine seeing that? Did he freak?
Well, he said, I can't tell you what he said on the air.
No, you can't.
But basically, he said, he was like, it took him, he said he almost killed himself because he was coming up as fast as he did.
You might be able to get away with saying it on your internet radio show, but you can't say it on this one.
Oh, no. I don't think I can get away with it there either. But it was very graphic, to say the least, and it really scared him. And he said even today, 40 years later, it still scares him. He said, because as best as he could tell, even as advanced as the U.S. military is today, we could not have touched these things even if we wanted to.
See, and I think just what makes this so entirely credible is the fact that, you know, a flotilla of ships, there's a submarine involved, people are trying to figure out just what the heck's going on, and the fact that witnesses saw these two craft smash out of the ocean and take off, I mean, to me, that doesn't sound like a crashed airplane.
Well, as far as I know, I mean, George, you know anything that we have? We don't have any flying
nothing.
Boats that I know of.
Look, I was in the Navy 9 years, Joe. We don't have anything that could fly and go and get submerged, at least not that I know of, and not back in 1967.
Well, I'll tell y'all what, I got a little bit of experience with the Navy. I got 3 advanced degrees in electronics and 3 advanced degrees in avionics with the USS Navy. I was on the USS Nimitz.
Oh, were you? Okay.
And the thing about it is, and you know, one of the first things you know, you're in the service, it's aircraft recognition. Pretty much everybody who's in the service learns this.
Yep.
And, you know, it's so, you know, when you hear a Navy person giving you a description of something he's seen, you pretty much can take it to the bank. That's what he saw. And when you have several of them from 2 or 3 different ships talking about, and it is something I found interesting because a lot of these guys are now in their late 60s, that they are willing to come. I guess they feel like they don't have anything to lose, but there have been several of them that have approached us and may be willing to talk about this on the air. And I would love to be able to corroborate one of these guys were on one of these ships at the time and get him on the air because it's a very significant story. And, you know, one of the other things I found interesting, too, was when they said, you know, how they were describing when the second ship was approaching the first ship, because there was divers in the water, by the way, from what I hear when the ship was coming up. One of the things I had heard as the ship approached the crippled vessel, the divers that were in the water near the crippled ship were actually moved away, what they describe as some kind of field. It didn't hurt them or anything. It just pushed them. I think they said about 150-yard perimeter about around both ships, and they couldn't approach any closer than that. It was like running into a wall. Now, I know that's a technology we don't possess. That's not even something we probably will possess for another 100 years.
A great researcher in all of this, Chris Stiles, says that most observations and statements came from professionals involved in the search, and that included military brass.
Yeah, because and that's something I guess we didn't even mention that. There was an official search done in Shag Harbor for what they thought it was a small aircraft. Mid-size, something like maybe a Lear class or something along that class they thought went down in the harbor. And I think that's what most people don't realize is this was reported as an airplane crash. And there was an investigation done, and there was, well, not a full investigation, but there was an investigation done, and there was a search going on, an active search going on, until someone seen this thing leaving the harbor. And even then, most people didn't believe it when they seen this thing take off, which I would have been the same way. If I'd have been sitting in my boat looking and seen this glowing light just take off under the water, I'd have been going, okay, maybe I'm in over my head here.
There was some report of some yellowish foam, which was coming up to the ocean top. Did you investigate that or find out anything more about that?
Most everybody seems to agree, and I really don't know if this is true or not, George, but most everybody seems to agree that they think there was some type of leak in maybe the fuel system. Because the foam, the few descriptions I've got, one guy said that, who was it? The young guy, I can't think of his name right now, but he was a young guy that was in one of the boats. The guy had picked him up when he was walking out there. And he said when they touched the foam, that it kind of just disintegrated in their hands. It just kind of turned to air once it left the confines of the water. So it was some kind of chemical that evaporated quickly when it wasn't when it wasn't touching the water. So, and you know, if you've worked around JP4 or JP5, they're the same way. If they're sitting on top of the water, it'll float there all day. But if you take it and lift it up off the water, that JP4 will evaporate in a matter of seconds. And that's a high grade, you know, jet fuel. So I'm thinking maybe that's what it was. And that may have been why the other craft had to be there. I mean, if it had a fuel leak of some kind, it probably couldn't fly in space or in the atmosphere for long. But what bothers me is it was described as hovering, and then it went down. It was almost like there was an onboard explosion or something, and then it went down. Now, as far as I know, I don't think our government can shoot down UFOs, but I may have been wrong on that one.
Well, I'm going to read a little bit about this, too. During the story, they said the fantastic part about it was the the attempted recovery operation at some point 25 miles up from Nova Scotia, and That's incredible, too. And again, that gets into where I'm talking about the Soviet sub and everything else. That just is amazing.
There's a gentleman, I think his name is Karanovich. He swears up and down. Now, I've heard him on a couple of European radio shows. He swears he was on board the Russian sub. And he says they had orders to intercept at whatever cost.
Why? But why would they do that?
Because they, I feel like, and this will segue to Roswell right quick, I feel like that we were given some technology. And probably the Russians and even the Chinese and probably now even more countries know that we were.
They wanted it.
And they wanted it. It was, they want to level the playing field, which you can't blame them for that. I mean, but if you pay, and I'm sure you're aware of this yourself, if you look at the United States over the last 40 years, technologically, we're leaving everybody behind. I mean, we're moving at a rate in the way we're designing computers and weapons, which really scares me, by the way, but we're moving in patterns that we're looking like we're 40, 50, 60, 70 years ahead of the Russians.
Yeah, we may be giving up manufacturing, but we are moving way ahead in terms of high technology.
And we are, and that had to come from somewhere. Granted, we may be just be smarter, brighter, and faster than everybody else. I don't personally believe that's what it is. I just don't think that we're that much smarter than most of the countries on the planet.
Yeah, well, I think we're the best, but this is incredible technology.
Yeah, and some of the stuff I've been hearing about lately from the new missiles, from the new laser defense systems with the backup missile defense systems, you know, these are systems that we shouldn't be having for another 50, 100 years. I mean, these some of the lasers I've heard about, like, you've seen the original Star Wars laser they were building, right? The one they used to shoot the disc up in the space out there.
Yeah, of course.
Well, that thing was originally designed, it was way too big to shoot down missiles.
Wow.
I don't know what they were planning on shooting with it, George, but it wasn't missiles.
You know, when we open up the phone lines next hour, if there's anybody who could call us from Canada on the international line, specifically out in the Shag Harbor area, please do so. I don't know why the case, basically, though, other than Chris Stiles investigating, was dropped. I mean, nobody followed through with it. What happened?
Well, I think for some people, they just got scared.
I mean, Stanton Friedman did some work on it in the beginning.
Yeah, I talked to him about that, but he really wasn't into it. I also talked to Whitley Strieber. He had done some forwards for some people, and it doesn't seem like most people wanted to get involved with this. And I don't understand it because the case was so good. If I'd have been around as an investigator when this happened, I'd have been all over this. There's just no way I could have left it alone. I'd have probably spent every dime I had just trying to figure out what's going on. But in today's society, I got to be honest, the witnesses are limited. And it's not so much the witnesses, it's being able to corroborate what they're saying. Because I can sit here and give you speculation all night long, but you know both of us want the same thing. We want to be able to say, hey, John Blow was over here on top of this frigate at this time trying to recover this craft on this date, and that's what we're looking for. And getting that is really hard. And I have heard recently that there's been some records released. I'm waiting to hear about that. Some records released on Shag Harbor the military was holding on deployments, both for the U.S. and the Canadian Coast Guards. So that might yield something we haven't seen yet, George. But that's the thing. It's there's a lot of good witnesses, both in civilian and in military class. There was also some civil services witnesses as well. So you got a real good platitude of witnesses here, and you have a very accurate accounting of what happened from when it was above the water till it hit the water, and then as it went and found the other one, and then you have several good witnesses on what was happening while it was under the water. But you're right. Most investigators won't touch it. It's one of the cases we have posted on our website. It's considered to be one of the most credible UFO cases in existence. And we try to tell everybody about it because I want everybody at least to look at it. You know, even if you're a young investigator, you need to look at this case because it's going to give you an insight on how advanced these ships are, and secondly, how our government deals with contact.
Well, and the fact that it moved up 25 miles.
Yeah, I know.
That's the incredible part for me.
Well,
it moved away.
It just, from what I heard, it just kind of went. You know, it wasn't like this thing was in a real big hurry from the way I understand.
Right.
It just seemed to just move at its own pace. It wasn't like it was worried about the government or it wasn't worried about us.
How far down was it?
You know, when they set off the coast of Nova Scotia, they were talking deep, somewhere around a mile, most people say. Whether or not that's true, you know, that one's tough because sending divers down a mile back then,
unless
that's borderline.
They were, you know, deep sea suits.
Yeah, that was borderline. And from the equipment they were telling me, they were wearing pressure equipment, but they weren't wearing that heavy gauge
Sounds like the movie The Abyss, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I'm thinking more probably around 500 or 600 feet is where I'm thinking they were sitting. But if we had divers in suits in the water back then, I'm figuring 500 or 600 feet. Now, if we had them in bells, that's different. But if we had them in suits, I'm figuring about 500 or 600 feet for back then. And even then, their time in the water would have been, it would have been cold. They wouldn't have been able to stay in for long periods of time, 20, 30 minutes tops. And they would have been back topside. Now, I was told, and whether or not we'll ever see this is anybody's guess, that there were both 8-millimeter and 35-millimeter photos taken underwater and above the water of this thing by the U.S. military. So I would love to pay money to see that. But you and I both know it's not the military that's controlling these projects. Somebody else is controlling that.
Oh, that's true. I want to get your take on the Betty and Barney Hill case when we come back, Joe. Okay. We'll also talk about Roswell. And then we'll open up the phone lines next hour as well, especially if any of you live in the Shag Harbor area in Nova Scotia. Check in with us on the international line next hour. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And Lex has linked up both of Joe's websites. They are right under his name at coasttocoastam.com. Joe, do you travel much? You were mentioning you do go to a few conferences.
Yeah, well, I'll be speaking at Roswell this year for the 60th anniversary, so y'all all be sure to come down and hear me. It will be on abduction research, by the way. And there will be several abductees present during this and after. There will be a panel afterwards. But, yeah, I actually do quite a bit of traveling. On average, we probably log 30,000, 40,000 miles a year in. We're on the road a lot. We spend a lot of time, you know, between states doing investigation cases. We have an ongoing case that we keep in Gulf Breeze on. About 10 years ago, we noticed that we were used to go to this place out there on, it's called Pearl Beach. It's in Gulf Breeze, Florida. And we started noticing people's cars parked there. And we started a research because they were never in their cars.
Where were they?
Apparently, they were being abducted because they weren't there.
We'll be back. Don't go away. It was this case that got me fascinated with UFOs. My mother brought me the Look magazine article that occurred a long time ago about Benny and Barney Hill. And Joe, after I read that about their so-called abduction, I was hooked. And I had to read every UFO book, every story I could find at a real young age.
Yeah, well, Betty and Barney Hill, now, most people don't like my take on Betty and Barney Hill, George. I got to be honest with you. It's not that I don't think they had a contact experience. I don't know. Are you familiar with the MILAB experience? The MILABs?
No. Tell me about that.
Well, the thing about it is when we go over their experience, we're looking for criteria. Okay. Well, first one of the first things that bothered me was the amniocentesis. I've interviewed thousands of contactees. They don't use a physical technology like that. It's not a needle. They're not using a needle-based technology. One of the first things that bothered me about the case. Second thing is she talked about walking up physical stairs. That's not something else you hear in 95% of contactees. And even the ones where they do say they walk in the ship, it's never upstairs. So those two things kind of stood out. And then she talked about, well, you ever listen to how she's talking? It's almost like a drug-induced state. Well, she describes it herself as a drug-induced state.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as far as we know, they don't use drugs of any kind. They don't really need them. They can manipulate the nerves in your mind quite fine or in your system without drugs at all. So as far as we know, they don't use drugs in any shape, form, or fashion. And we don't hear contactees talk about being groggy or they'll talk about being, you know, feeling rough from having a contact experience, but either they remember or they don't. It's not real groggy feeling or real, you know, like you'd been drugged up or doped up or something. And then the way she describes talking to the aliens, 99.95% of all contactees are telepathic communications. It's rare that you hear that an alien speaks, and most of the time if they do, it's not something you can discern with your ears. In other words, you don't recognize the language. It's not English. With the reptilians and even with the greys, it's more like the dolphins' language than yours, like ours. It's not even a word form language. These things stood out. So, you know, from what I heard and what I read about the investigation, everybody had assumed they were alien abductees. And I was like, well, there was definitely an abduction that went on here. But from my professional point of view, I would have had to say it was a military abduction and not an alien abduction.
That's interesting. We'll talk more about that. Back in 1961, the Hills met a member of what was then the UFO group, NICAP. You remember that one?
Oh, yeah. I remember NICAP.
Now, this fellow's name was Walter Webb. He was a lecturer for Boston's Museum of Sciences at the Charles Hayden Planetarium. And he says, though highly skeptical of the case at the time, I was impressed that the Hills underplayed the dramatic aspects of the case. They were not trying to sensationalize. They did not seek publicity. And it was through Webb that the Hills realized that they had lost more than 2 hours during their trip.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he came away thinking, well, something happened to him. Like you just said, something did happen to him. And I had interviewed Dr. Benjamin Simon, who was the psychiatrist who did some work in hypnosis therapy with them. I can't find those tapes anymore. I was 21 years old when I interviewed him. That would have been 1971. And this case, of course, occurred back in 61, right?
Yeah, 61, yeah, 1961.
And so, you know, he, I wish I had them. But he began a six-month series of therapy at the Hills' own expense, starting in 1963, and they told, here's the thing, they both told, under hypnosis, virtually identical stories about humanoid-looking men dressed in tight-fitting black uniforms. Do you believe if this was a military operation, they tried to trick the Hills?
I think it was. I think this was a deliberate attempt by the U.S. government to get this into the public, and I think they used Betty and Barney Hill to do it. I hate to say that because it makes a lot of people mad, but the thing about it is I think our government needed this subject to be in the American public for their disclosure project, because most people don't realize is the government is disclosing this. They've never denied the existence of extraterrestrials. They've never denied the existence of UFOs. You're not going to find any government official that says ET doesn't exist, because they're not going to say it. And they want this disclosed, but they want us to disclose it. And they're willing to let us go out here and do this, but, you know, they want it disclosed as much as we do. It's just they're not going to be the ones that disclose it, which I'm sure they have a lot at stake. But educating the population on this is a good thing. I mean, it's something that needs to be done, and I think if the government really wanted to stop it, they could stop it pretty quickly. So with people like myself, let's be honest, I travel a lot. If they wanted to make me go bye-bye, it wouldn't be real hard to stage an accident, or any of us, for that matter, who does this. So, you know, with those things taken into consideration, it just seems like the government set this up so that they could get this work to the general public in a manner where it wouldn't be taken too seriously.
Well, John Fuller, who wrote the book The Interrupted Journey, which really jump-started this, and his book was pretty silent until Look magazine, as I mentioned, back in 66, took a couple, two parts and excerpts from his book, made his book a bestseller. He, unfortunately, died in 1990 of cancer. I would have loved to have interviewed him.
And that's the thing. I mean, it's hard to get information. I was very pervy. I met a friend of Betty's recently, who had done a lot of interviews with her. And matter of fact, I did an interview with her, and we went over some of the information. And, you know, Betty's had contact since then, according to her, with extraterrestrials since then. But I remembered listening to the interviews, she's describing a different type of alien in her new contact versus what she's talking about in this particular case in 1961. And from what it sounds, it sounds like a physical technology, a technology that we would use. Everything that they described, even the type of craft, because they described it kind of like a banana or a pancake, more like one of the flying wedge type craft. It's the sounds of it. It sounds more earthly than it sounds extraterrestrial. And I really do think the government did this because, you know, she said herself they were human sized. They weren't, you know, the reptilians and the human aliens are both quite a bit bigger than us. So there's no, just, you know, when you see them, you know. And the grays aren't bigger than us, but they look so much different than us that it's not hard to tell. In her case, these aliens look closer to us. If they were an alien at all, they were a hybrid, because they do kind of sound like a human hybrid. But in this particular case, from the types of experiments done to the attitude of the contactee theirself, I'd have to put it as a military abduction.
What about the star map, though, that they came up with?
Well, you know, I found that interesting. And this was the dangest thing. I was talking about this one night on Pal Talk in a chat room, and we were talking about this, and I told this guy, you know, the only thing I find that really gives Betty and Barney Hill's case real solid credibility for being aliens is the star map.
Yes.
Well, about 2 or 3 days passes by, he brings me this picture of a rock from the Dogon tribe, and guess what map it was?
Well,
it was the same one Betty and Barney Hill did. Now, you see,
but
that helped and hurt them.
Well, I don't think they would have been aware of the Dogon tribe back in that era.
They wouldn't have been, but the government would have been. See, that's what I'm saying. Betty and Barney, I don't think there was any deception on Betty and Barney Hill's part at all, by the way.
All right. Now, that's important that you say that.
Yeah, I want everybody to understand that. I do not think there was any deception on Betty and Barney Hill's part at all. I think the deception was put on Betty and Barney Hill. I don't even think they, you know, even if they would have lived longer, I don't think they would have ever realized it. I really feel like because of the technologies involved in the abduction itself and the way the abduction was handled, you know, because we investigate military abductions today. It's not that uncommon. About one out of every 15 abductees experiences one. They're describing what Betty and Barney Hill is describing.
I'm gonna do something that I normally never do, Joe, and that's to take a side. Most of the time, I like to just go right down the middle and let the guests do their thing.
No, that's good.
But because the Barney and Betty Hill case really changed my life at an age of 16 years old and pushed me in the direction that I have now gone, and because of this case, I could not stop. I believe that something happened to them of some kind of magnitude that was out of this world. The military, my mind was too young to comprehend a military plot. And I'm not going to discount that at any point. But something tells me that something very alien and extraterrestrial happened to this couple.
Well, you know, I don't rule out the hybrid thing. Because they may be using a more terrestrial-based technology, more human-based technology. So I'm not willing to rule out. It's just we can rule out, like, the Greys, the reptilians, and the humans. We can just rule that out altogether. We know that was not the experience that Betty and Barney Hill had because of the research that we've done. So we can move them right out of there and say, okay, we know that's not what it is. So it doesn't leave us with much. It could be a new type of alien, like, you know, Charles Hall talks about the tall whites and stuff like that. So it could have been a different type of alien, or it could have been one of the hybrid programs, or it could have been a military. It could have been a combination, too.
Well, it's kind of funny because Barney, under hypnosis, when he saw the craft, thought it was military, and he said, how interesting. There is a military pilot, and he's looking at me. And then he realized, you know what, there's something stranger. He thought they were going to kill him and his wife. Because they had apparently seen some kind of top-secret military aircraft,
which is interesting. Well, that's not that uncommon for a MIL lab to have a cover memory implanted over what they actually saw, because we'll find both. We'll find what actually happened, and then we'll find the government memory that was laid over it to make it into something else. That's not that uncommon of a thing, and it's a tough case because it does involve a physical-type technology. Even the reptilians and the humans, the human aliens, they use a physical technology, but much more advanced than what we're talking
about. Well, here's something else that's interesting. At the time, Peace Air Force Base in Portsmouth, right?
Mm-hmm.
They apparently recorded on radar, and it's in a report, at the exact same time the Hills apparently had their run-in with this UFO, some kind of strange, anomalous object on radar.
Yeah,
that's bizarre.
Actually, the way I heard the report, it was after Betty and Barney Hill, and it was a confirmation to what they had seen, but it was seen over the military base. It was actually sighted, physically seen over the military base. See, that lends more credence to the military abduction.
Well, whatever it was, the radar specialist registered it as unknown.
Oh, I'm sure he did, because he probably didn't know anything about it. That's not somebody that's going to have that kind of classification. But the fact that it was seen in two different locations on the same night, and one of them being a military base, really helps put it more towards. But, see, that doesn't mean it wasn't alien either.
No, I know.
Well, I want to be honest, because I know people, I may be confusing people here that's listened to us, and I really don't want to. The thing about this is more than likely there was a government involvement in this case. What we need to find out is, was it a government-controlled case, or was this an extraterrestrial where the government was present and doing some of the monitoring and some of the experiments.
Well, now you may be onto something there. I mean, it's possible this might have been a joint operation.
Well, it sounds like it was, but it's going to be hard to prove to us.
Yeah.
But it does sound more because of the technologies used.
And the three players are dead. Dr. Simon is dead. Barney and Betty Hill are dead. And it's gone, other than what we have is their tapes. And somewhere somebody has the tapes that Dr. Simon used when he recorded them.
I only ever heard the regression tapes one time about 26 years ago. And the thing about it is I haven't been able to find anything related to it since. And I have tried. I've called friends of mine that I know have really good influential positions, and nobody can seem to come up. I would just like to get a recording of the original cassettes of the Betty and Barney Hill hypnosis and regression. And I'd like to sit down with some of our counselors, because we have our own people now that could, you know. Because one of the things I heard, and I got to be honest about this, one of the things I heard, and this is from some of the people who work with us that do regression, was that a lot of the questions asked during the regression would have been considered leading questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know actually how much of this now is actual memory and how much of it was actual suggestion.
That's why you got to hear it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and we have to hear it to determine that. And once we determine that, that'll also help a lot more in which direction we want to file this case in. You know, right now, if I had to file it and close the case, I'd have to file it as a joint case between some type of alien and the government. And that's where I'd have to file it. And I would like to know a little bit more detail before we get that.
Well, and even at that point, that's incredible.
Oh, yeah, it is. That's incredible. And you're not getting no argument out of me on this, because it is. And the case is a good case because it shows you that, yes, there was some kind of event that happened here that was earth-changing to these two people, just utterly earth-changing. And let's be honest, George, this is a black and white couple we're talking about who decided to go public in 1961 with being an abductee. This took an immense amount of courage. You know, neither one of these things would have been considered acceptable in 1961, and for them to come out and do this is enough to show the people right there something substantial happened to this guy and this girl that made them take the chance of putting themselves in national exposure.
There's something, Joe, out there by Zeta Reticuli.
Yeah, there's something out
that
there.
That system.
Well, that and the Dogon system.
And that's Sirius.
Sirius, right. And the Sirius system. And because one of the interesting things about that is you know, they have Sirius A, and then they found Sirius B, and then the Dogon also predicted Sirius C, which I think they found in 76. So they predicted the last two stars they found, plus the Dogon. And this is what's always bothered me. You know, all these archaeologists and all these people want to have such a fit over the Dogon, but their calendar is based on the same exact orbit of Sirius B, 55.5 years. And they do know the composition of the star. That's an impossibility for an African tribe. That's impossible.
With no technology. And I don't think they had telescopes.
No, besides this, you have to have a radio telescope. It's invisible to the naked eye. You can't see it without a radio telescope. So we know they didn't have that. So these kind of things are significant. These are things that we can physically trace on our own planet. But yet, at least 60% of the world wants to ignore it. You know, that always amazes me. What is it in us that doesn't want to know the truth? That's what bothers me. You know,
go ahead, finish up.
Well, I was just, you know, it just bothers me because in general, it's almost like 60 or 70% of the planet is walking through this brainwashed state of, I'm the soccer dad, mom, I got to take my kids, I got to go to the store, I got to go to the mall, I got to have lunch, and, well, maybe there's aliens, who really cares? Well, it's a substantial thing, ladies and gentlemen. If the planet's being visited, it's the biggest thing that's ever going to happen to this planet. And I just, you know, for me, for the life of me, I just have to sit back and wonder why. Because there's enough data now that if you sit down and do your homework, you can tell there's something going on.
Well, here, Travis Walton, 75.
Mm-hmm.
Shag Harbor, 67.
Mm-hmm.
Betty and Barney Hill, 61. Mm-hmm. Roswell, 47. Over a 28-year period, we've had some, and these are just several cases. We've had incredible cases, UFO cases, but we're not getting them anymore. Why not?
Yeah, well, we get them to an extent. I mean, you had the cases like Hami Masanjaman reporting.
Yeah, and I'm not counting, you know, what we saw over Phoenix or over Chicago. We're not getting the close encounters of the third kind type cases.
No, we're not. Like what you just said about Phoenix, we got really good investigators out in Phoenix, you know, and they're investigating and they're telling us if they're flares, if they're not flares. But you're right, it's not the close encounter case. It's the case of the lights hovering over a city, hanging out, checking things out, moving around, but not ever really seeming to make contact. It's kind of a standoffish type sighting. It's a really good sighting, and as David Andrews, our Phoenix State Director, would tell you, it's very worth checking out and investigating. But it is not a close encounter of the third kind. Even the cases in the ones we're hearing in Florida now, which is a lot of sightings going on Florida, there is no any of those. Now, I have to tell you, you know, I live in New Orleans, Georgia, and right after Katrina, I was home 3 days after the storm because I'm a contractor. And we started getting reports from both the National Guard and the NOPD of what appeared to be reptilian aliens walking on Elysian Field in downtown New Orleans. Now, to the best of my knowledge, this is the first time anybody's ever reported anything like this. And we had seven reports of this. Now, just recently, I was informed by a friend of mine who's a friend of Linda Moulton Howe's that she's got a report of someone seeing a reptilian alien walking the streets in New Orleans. That in itself is just literally amazing to me.
Yeah, I think so. Stay with us, Joe. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And now we'll take phone calls this hour. We're going to keep the international line open to those of you who live in the Nova Scotia area that might have any information on the Shag Harbor incident from 1967. And we'll talk a little bit about this bizarre story of reptilians wandering around New Orleans. Are you sure? We'll be back on Coast to Coast AM. Joe, before we take some more calls, we'll talk a little bit about Travis Walton this hour as well, but let's talk a little bit more about these reptilians wandering the streets of New Orleans. I mean, did a lot of people see this?
Actually, George, this was really, really weird. I had evacuated New Orleans and went to stay in Destin, Florida, and being a contractor, we decided to come back right as soon as they would let us back in,
sure,
which was about 4 days. Well, we loaded up with generators, scroll back in the city. We were home about 4 days, had just got our house cleaned out, had the generators running, you know, doing the routine of living in the city in a disaster. And we get a phone call, okay, from a guy who's a National Guard, and he said that he seen, he described was an amphibian-type reptilian walking through waist-deep water on Elysian Fields, downtown New Orleans. Elysian Fields is right behind the old city. It's part of the Vieux Carré. And the French Quarter. And the thing about it is you know, it was him and three other National Guard guys that had seen it on this particular day. First, I found it interesting that someone took the time to find my phone number from downtown New Orleans in the middle of 7 days after Katrina.
Oh, yeah.
To call me about a reptilian. So I was kind of like, well, it can't be a hoax. So called the guy back, talked to him about it. About 2 days passed. And a gentleman from the New Orleans Police Department called, backing up what these four National Guard guys said they had saw. Altogether, there was four National Guard guys and three New Orleans Police Departments that said on at least three occasions they seen what appeared to be 6 to 7 foot tall lizard-like creatures with gills walking through the old city.
That's so bizarre.
Now, you know, all I can do is take these guys at their word. There's really nothing else I can do with this. None of them are willing to come on the air. I've asked all of them if they would be. I asked if I could use their names. One or two of them said from the National Guard said they might allow us to post their information to the Internet. But that's as much as I can get them to do. So we have the account. We have the report. We have the names. We have the phone records. And I can't really see, first of all, I don't even know how they found us. There was no form of communications. There was no Internet at all unless you happen to have dial-up like we did. I still had high-speed cable, by the way. My cable didn't go out during Katrina. Neither did my phone line. But as soon as I hooked up the generator, we actually had all of that. But, I mean, these guys had to come off their duty, go find an Internet connection somewhere, look me up on the Internet, or look in the Times-Picayune logs because they had done a full-page interview on us down here, and find my phone number and call me to tell me about this.
Now, you're sure these weren't like scuba divers that they saw or anything like that?
No. The first account, from what they told me, is the National Guard, when they walked up on them, they walked up on them with M16s drawn, locked and loaded, walking up on these things. And they said as they approached them, they got this weird, strange feeling. And then the next thing they knew, they were walking away with their guns slung, but the aliens were still standing there. As far as I know, there was no form of communication or anything else. It was just they walked up on them with guns down, turned around and walked off with guns put up. So something happened. You know, there's a couple of seconds there that something happened, but that was it. And they were amazed by it, and they said, all seven of them said they felt compelled to report this. And I asked them how they found me. The one guy said it was just sheer coincidence. He had seen an old newspaper in somebody's derelict house, and there was the article. But I don't even know how the other guys found us. Those kind of coincidences are just really weird.
Well, and as you know, Joe, I don't believe in those. Synchronicity. Things happen for a reason. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to the international line, Joe. Let's see what that is. Maybe it's from Nova Scotia. Hello there.
Hi, George.
Welcome to the show. Are you from Nova Scotia?
I was in Nova Scotia in 1967. I happened to be in the Navy in 1967.
Ah.
Stationed at Halifax. But I didn't hear any scuttlebutt about that.
Nothing.
And usually, scuttlebutt goes around pretty quick.
Yeah, it does.
Well, it did happen. What it was, we don't know, but there was a major episode in October 67.
Right. I'll tell you who. Paul Hellyer was defense minister at that time.
Yes.
And he should know exactly what went on there.
Good idea.
Because, and it wasn't long after that he was gone.
Well, and he's very vocal now about extraterrestrials.
Well, it seems funny that he's coming out wanting all the governments of the world to come forth with what they know, and he should be the first one, because he was right there as defense minister. He would have firsthand knowledge of that.
All right, that's a great idea.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, George.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Have you ever talked to Paul Hellyer?
Actually, I met him, where was it? One of the conferences. I only got to talk to him for a short time. But
yeah, he's 83, but man, he is hot and heavy to get governments to disclose.
He does. But, you know, I was thinking what this gentleman just said. Would our government actually have told the Prime Minister of Canada what they were doing? They don't tell them now what they're doing.
I don't think so.
You know, that's the thing. I don't think they would have bothered telling them.
No, but he might have heard about the case.
He might have, yeah.
But it's interesting he didn't.
It would be interesting to ask him face to face or even on the air if he knows anything about it, just to get a permanent answer, you know, yes or no.
First time caller line, you're up with us. Hello there.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi, George. This is Paul from Hillsborough, Oregon.
Hi. Thank you.
And I wanted to tell you about my UFO experience in England in about 1989 or 91. Some friends of me walked into a cathedral in Peterborough in England.
Okay.
And the cathedral was famous for Mary, Queen of Scots, and Catherine of Aragon was buried there. And we walked inside this big archway, and we looked up and saw this chrome object about 150 feet over our heads. It had an orange flame, headed east over the cathedral, and began maneuvering at high speed, zigzagging, and stopping immediately without slowing down and stuff.
How big would you estimate the object to be?
I'd say SUV-sized.
Okay. Small, generally, then.
Generally, yeah, kind of small, about the size of an average vehicle or SUV. And when it departed to the south, and it was on the horizon in 2 seconds. It just shot off so fast.
And you kept saying to yourself, it's got to be a plane, but I know it isn't.
I figured governmental or experimental aircraft. And I told some friends about it at home, and they said they heard it on the radio, actually. And the local Royal Air Force denied that it was anything to do with them.
All right,
and,
great.
Yeah, that's my story. I love you, sir. I've been trying to call you since 2001 about my OBE experience, which I'll email to you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for sharing that story. You know, I have heard, Joe, that Howard Hughes, back years ago, experimented and tested some kind of an aircraft that had clear wings. Because they were being used only as bombers. They couldn't land. Once they took off, they couldn't land. They had small little gear-type wheels in order to take off, but they were just to carry bombs and drop over enemy targets. But they had clear wings, so that would have made them look like cigars up above, you know, when you were looking at. Had you ever heard of that?
I had heard mention of a couple of things Hughes might have been working on. Somebody had referred us that about 7 or 8 years ago. It was an old NICAP member I ran into who had actually said something to me about that. And we both just said the same thing. Well, it would be cool if we could find a document or a piece of paper, you know what I'm saying? Because let's be honest, George, I would take care of like 15% of the UFO cases for about 10 years.
Sure would. Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Good, sir. Thanks.
Pleasure to be on the show this evening. Well, I have a show this evening. As I have a theory as to why there maybe are not so many encounters anymore.
Okay. Love to hear.
That they've completed their phase of testing and are now implementing their plans, you know, through the NWO and Illuminati.
Well said.
For the upcoming 2012 changes, that all the abduction has been about. You know, it's no longer necessary, perhaps, that testing for emotion frequencies, response to shock tests, etc., were all the purpose of feeding the data about us through their computers with the data that enables them to control us. You know, that they've been doing this for the upcoming microchip implantation to control our emotions and thus control mankind through a higher influence than the media.
What do you think, Joe? They're into a new phase, perhaps?
Well, the research suggests that they're pretty much going along the same thing. It just doesn't seem like they're showing themselves publicly as much. And I really think that has more to do with the education of the general population than it does anything else. I think that because there's so many of us out there educating the population now, ET's less likely to show their face because, let's be honest, everybody carries digital cameras, camcorders. Hell, I think I got 5 of them I keep in my car alone. I really think it has more to do with that than anything else, even though I do think 2012 is a significant date, but I don't honestly know why.
November 5th, 1975, 7 men working in a national forest. They tell a story of fear, shock, and confusion, the Travis Walton case. I've had Travis on the program before. He's compelling. He's passed lie detector tests. What the heck happened to him, Joe?
Travis was, I hate to say this like this, but he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he paid for it. And that's really what it is. In his case, I mean, and unfortunately for me, I got the case kind of reversed because we had heard about it early on and had looked into it, but I had never took the time to read his book. So I seen the movie before I read the book, which was a mistake on my part, ladies and gentlemen. Let me tell you about that. The thing about it is when I sat down and read the book and really got through it, and I started really investigating the case and finding out how well the lie detectors were done. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, they did a fantastic – I wish I could get this guy who did these tests. He was to the point, and he was well-credentialed. So maybe you could have got 5 guys together and really programmed them to lie. I'm having a hard time with that one. I think these guys honestly experienced what they experienced. I think Travis – honestly experienced most of what he thinks. I don't know how much of it he recalls clearly and how much might be a fuzz, but I think he was too nosy for his own good. And what happened was is he walked up on that craft, and the way he says it, too, when I'm listening to him talk about it, and as a matter of fact, I've caught him interviewed on your show before, and the way he talks about walking up that ship, it just seems like, look, they kind of listed, okay, look, dude, you're getting close, and then, you got too close.
He got too close.
And that's really what it came down to. But it's kind of like, what's his name, Charles Hickson and Calvin, the Pascagoula case.
Yes.
You know, that's another one of simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Really, it was. I mean, they just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. And it's not often you hear about these isolated cases, but for me, these are control group studies. If you're doing, and like in Pascagoula, you know, there's a large group of contactees that happen to live in the deep south along the Gulf of Mexico. These people are being contacted on a regular basis. Well, you want a non-contactee to check out your situation, a control study. There you go. They got him. They did it. They put him back. And I really think that had a lot to do with Travis. I don't even think it was that. I think he was simply just being too nosy for his own good. I hate to say it like that, but I really do.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
My name is Bill. I'll tell you, you have a great show as always. Really good tonight.
Thank you, Bill.
I just wanted to comment on the Betty and Barney Hill story.
Sure.
I have 2 concerns with that. One, it wasn't reported until several years later, and they did it under hypnosis. And 2, these abductions bother me because there's no compelling physical evidence, no paperwork, no hardware they bring back from the spaceships. And I'm wondering if these are just lucid dreams. And particularly when they put them under hypnosis, they're just recounting these very vivid dreams they had.
Well, they would both have the same dream, though?
Well, they were very close. They were husband and wife. They shared the same experiences. but I'm just wondering if it was not a very vivid lucid dream. See, I don't believe there's any aliens visiting us. I just believe it's unexplained phenomenon that we just haven't come across the answer yet.
I'll let you take this, Joseph.
Well, let me start with the abduction thing first. So you know about 72% of all abductions happen during the daytime, usually on the drive to work or on the drive home. Most people are not even familiar with that. It seems to be more middle class rooted in the United States, too, by the way, middle and upper middle class for some reason, which is the controlling class, so it does make sense to me. The thing about it is they do happen like that, and if you can kind of try to, you know, put Betty and Barney Hill into the category where they were hallucinating, but the thing about it is in their case, being who they were, living in the era they did, coming forward could have been detrimental to them in a lot of ways. Hell, for that matter, they could have been stoned to death. And the thing about it is for them to do this, there was a driving force there. And the only thing I can think is if there was a driving force there, there was a physically real event that happened. It had to be something physically real to drive these two to put themselves out the way they did. They weren't making money on this. They weren't getting famous on it. It wasn't like it was going to pay their bills or anything else.
And they passed the lie detector test.
And they passed the lie detector test. And the thing of it is as far as Betty and Barney Hill is concerned, all the evidence suggests that there was a real physical event there. Like George and I were discussing earlier, it's what that event is. But the event itself was real. So knowing that, you can tell that it wasn't a hallucination or it wasn't hypnosis or anything along those lines. This was a physically real event. Now, as far as evidence versus abductions, there is some. There's been footprints found at sites where there's been setups done while recording. Unfortunately, there's been no video evidence, I can tell you that, not anything I would consider to be credible.
Weren't there some kind of magnetic circles or something on Barney's car at the time?
That was interesting you brought that up, because Stanton Friedman had mentioned something to me. You know, he used to work on nuclear aircraft for a living. That's what he did before he became a ufologist. And I actually did a show with him on that. And one of the things when you get like an EMP, a high impulse EMP, it's that magnetic field, the radiation can actually peel the paint off of a car. It'll break it. It's like hitting it with it's just like hitting it with a strong radio wave or a strong magnetic wave. It'll break it out and a little chip will come off. And you'll have exposed metal. They'll take it all the way through to the primer and just leave the exposed metal. That's one of the other reasons I was kind of wondering about the Betty and Barney Hill case, because of the type of craft involved, because you just don't hear that in other craft. You've heard them hovering over cars and moving the whole car, but the paint stayed intact. So that tells you that was a different type of propulsion altogether.
So let's review. Shag Harbor, you believe there was some kind of real episode there.
Yeah.
You don't know what. You think it was extraterrestrial?
Oh, I agree. I think it was extraterrestrial. I wholeheartedly think Shag Harbor was extraterrestrial.
Betty and Barney, you believe it was some kind of military intervention. You do not rule out, though, the fact that the military might have been working with some kind of extraterrestrial group.
Yeah, at this point, I would want to say that I would think this was a joint venture in Betty and Barney Hill. That it was both military and I think it was more military, but I do think the aliens were present during the abduction.
And the Travis Walton case, you think something major happened to them?
Oh, I think something major happened to him. I actually feel sorry for Travis, because he's one of these guys who, you know, he just was nosy. And the same thing I would do. I mean, if I seen a UFO hovering over the forest, I'm going to get out the car like a fool and walk over there and look at it. Which is what most curious people would do. So you can't really hate on him for it. It was a shame that it happened. But I do think it was a real physical event.
Tell us your websites again, Joe, before we take the break, sir.
It's www.icar1.com. That's the primary ICAR website. And you can always find us at www.paranormalradionetwork.com. That's where we broadcast from. So hop in and see us. And if you can't find us there, we're always in the ICAR UFO Alien Phenomena support group on Pal Talk.
How do people email you?
Oh, easy, icar@cox.net. Feel free. I check my emails every day. And if I'm not, I check all my emails personally, so you don't have to worry about it. If you send it to me, give me a couple of days to respond, because, you know, I do get a lot of email, but I will respond.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. Joe Montaldo, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. We'll take your phone calls, and don't forget the international line reserved for anybody else out in Nova Scotia that might have a little bit more evidence about the 1967 Shag Harbor episode. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I just got an email from someone who says they have tape of Betty Hill talking under hypnosis. So they're going to send me a copy of it. Let's hope I get it. And if I do, we'll put it on the air here on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Joe Maltondo is our guest, and we will take your phone calls as well. Joe, the work you do continues. How do you get the abduction cases?
Well, through stuff like this, being on your show tonight, being on other shows, keeping the online support groups running. And it's just a matter of letting people know we exist. Like I've heard from several of my fellow ufologists, we're considered the best-kept secret in ufology. And people do find us. We do introduce ourselves at conferences. We work press at a lot of the different conferences when we're there, and we're attending and reporting. And, you know, we have a lot of ICAR members that will be present, and we'll have investigators present. And really, I mean, otherwise than that, there's no real other way to do it. And we're looking, actively seeking contactees for information reasons. Guys, y'all can help us. We can help y'all. I can be honest about this. You can come anytime you want to the online support group on Pal Talk and talk to these people. There's literally, on any given day, there's 20, 30, 40 contactees in that room at any given time. And you can stop and you can talk to them. They'll express their stories to you. You can tell them. You can swap information. We also use it as a research medium. It works twofold. And we use that. My personal numbers are all listed on the Internet along with my 800 number for the organization. I'm very easy to get in touch with. All of my investigators are very easy to get in touch with. You know, we're here. That's what we're here for, to find contactees. We are looking for similarities in contact cases. To the best of my knowledge, we are the only group this large that is doing a study this large. And we're literally looking for as many thousands of contactees as we can find. Now, we do understand we're going to go through 400,000 people to get 40,000 contactees, but we're willing to do it. And we're willing to do it out of our own pocket. We're not even asking you to send money. ICAR's membership is totally free. Most ICAR is funded by myself and a few other close friends of mine. And because we want to know the truth. And everything we learn, we want to share, at least as much as we can without giving the story away. For me, it's hard, George, because I got a border between what I can give away and what abduction criteria I need to keep.
Yep.
You know, so I know who's telling the truth and who's not. And it makes it hard because personally, I'd like to just sit here and go down the list of everything we found in every abduction case that compares in all the cases. But then after that, anybody who called me could tell me they were an abductee, and it's really the only thing we have anymore to separate them. That and the simple fact of watching them, being with them, and working with them on a daily basis. And that's another thing, guys, that's something we guarantee. If you're a real contactee, and let me make this clear, if the organization investigates you and determines that you are a contactee, you have support anytime you need it in a numerous number of ways. But, you know, don't waste our time because it costs us a lot of money and a lot of time. I dedicate about 80 to 90 hours a week of my own time every week. If I did this for my company, I could have retired 5 years ago.
Absolutely. Let's go to some final calls. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, George?
Yes, sir.
Larry from Eagle Point, Oregon.
Hi,
talk with
Larry.
You before.
Sure. Thank you.
Betty and Barney Hill, this is really strange. A couple nights ago, I was thinking about Betty and Barney Hill, and now you're talking about it tonight. And the star chart did it for me, as far as I'm concerned. I've been studying. I've been an amateur astronomer since my mid-teens. When I was 18 years old and 61, I spent the whole summer. I never will forget this. My dad had a little tool shack out in the back. Spent the whole summer learning the constellations, so I knew what was up there. And most of the satellites that were launched after that, I knew everyone. I could name them for you, so I knew what was up there. And I've seen 5 sightings myself. Unfortunately, nothing real close, but I call them UFOs. But I'm a little nervous. That's what I'm shaking. I'm not used to talking. But what I want to say, I don't want to be too long, but I've seen Betty on TV being hypnotized. I've read about her. Plain people don't know anything about astronomy. You know, I mean, to me, that really affirmed my belief in extraterrestrials, even though I was made fun of. You know, I was a nut because I believed in them, but I stuck to my guns, and I still do. And I'm not that far from Wright Pad Air Force Base, and that's their whole story. I won't get into that, but there's a lot of sightings at Wright Pad Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and I've been there. But what I wanted to say, besides Betty and Barney Hill, my ex-wife, I lived most of my life in Indiana. I'm out here in Oregon now, the last 3 years. She was ESP. She had ESP, definitely. And this wasn't ESP, but she was at a laundromat in Winchester, Indiana. That's where I was born and raised. And I have to tell you this. I think it's remarkable. And Close Encounters of the Third Kind, I believe, was put out in 69, I believe.
70s. 70s.
Okay,
yeah.
Well,
sometime
we were married.
In the
70s. Well, we went to the movie, okay? This is before she saw the UFO. And we watched the movie. And it wasn't, I bet you it wasn't, a few months later, she came home from the laundromat and says, Larry, says, I saw this UFO. It's pulsating lights. It's going around and around. We lived in a small town with a glass factory. It was hanging around this glass factory. And it took off, and I was just, my heart was beating 1,000 miles a minute. Anyway, we went after it, and of course it was gone. But she described it to me, and I says, describe it to me, and says, in the show, what it looked like, which one in the show, and she described it right to the T as one of the little ones that came out of the mothership. She described it right to the T, and she never made anything up. So I don't care what anybody says. As far as I'm concerned, I think the extraterrestrials have been here for thousands of years.
Well, some people believe we got seeded by them.
Yeah, oh yeah, there's all kinds of theories, and all, you know, there's all kinds of, but I think they've been here for a long time.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate you being on the program. By the way, Close Encounters, 1977. So he's a believer, Joseph.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, somebody asked me the other day, do you believe in extraterrestrials? I have to tell him no, because I don't believe. For me, it's a fact of life. I've seen the evidence. I'm convinced beyond any reasonable doubt, so it's not a belief system. And I tell people this all the time. Don't believe in E.T. Go out there, do your homework, and you'll find out it's a fact. You don't have to believe in it. And it's really one of the things we try to get across. We want people to educate. I tell people all the time, you can come listen to me speak every day. Don't take me at my word. Back it up. Look at the research. Do your own homework, because it's important that you learn this for yourself, because that's the only way you're going to really understand that this is really going on, and it's the only way you're going to be able to want to stand up for it.
By the way, let me, I need to get this out very quickly. Joe, anybody in British Columbia near the Kelowna, K-E-L-O-W-N-A airport, if there's anything unusual going on there, fast blast me as quickly as you can before I get off the air here. Would you? I appreciate that. I don't know what's going on. Somebody just called with something very strange. And just, if you live in that area, if you can check it out, let's see what it might be. I'm not going to report on it until we can check it out, but hopefully you can send us the information. Let's go back to the phones. We shall go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. First-time listener as well.
Well, thank you, sir.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm 44, grew up on the East Coast, and in the early 70s, we would visit family friends in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And we were kids. We would sit out on the roof of this little tool shed in the backyard of this family. And there was this one little redhead, freckle-faced kid, a son in that family, would stare up at those stars with it for hours, convinced that there were UFOs and other things up there. And his name was and is Larry Warren. And Larry is this guy, I don't know his whole story. He joined the Air Force, the United States Air Force, went to Great Britain somewhere. It was either in England or Scotland, and claims to have had a very close encounter. Do you know about his story, Joe?
I don't know. For some reason, it sounds familiar, but I hate to quote on something without having data in front of me, because honest with you, I look at hundreds of cases, so they all kind of, if I'm not looking at them per se, they kind of all go together.
Yeah,
so.
I have not heard of. Sometimes they don't use their real names.
Well,
yeah,
his real name is Larry Warren, and
Larry Warren from Rendlesham.
Yeah, that's the one.
Oh yeah, I know Larry Warren. Actually,
with him. Essentially, what do you make of his story?
You know, when Peter Robbins asked me to talk to Larry, I was kind of like, why not? It's Rendlesham. You know, he said he was there because what happens is I kind of believe what he's saying. I'm not 100% sure that everything he's saying is what he thinks it is. One of the things we learn with contact situations is we can only judge these situations by our own perception, and as humans, our perception is very limited, let me tell you. And so each individual is going to, sometimes they see things that are the same, but they describe them differently. And in his case, I think that's what's going on, but he's very convincing in the fact that what happened to him happened to him. And,
he stayed on his story for a very long time. He essentially seems even estranged from his family over it.
Yeah, he does. And he pretty much put his whole livelihood and reputation on the line for this. And he's fairly convincing. I mean, I haven't done enough research on him personally, you know, for a character judgment. But the two times that I've talked to him and the evidence he's presented has been pretty consistent. And it's not inconsistent with the rest of what went on at Rendlesham. It seems to fit in. It just seems to be another part.
When I tell you as children, we would sit and look up at the stars, and he was convinced then that he was going to see UFOs and have encounters, does that tell you anything about someone's proclivity?
Well, it could, but in reality, I'm going to say this bluntly. If you have an IQ 100 or over, you should realize that we are not alone in the universe. I mean, that is bottom line. And, I mean, it's too big of a place with too many stars and too many planets. I mean, I'm listening to NASA and the European Space Agency. They're planning on finding life in 5 or 6 planets in our own solar system, much less in the rest of the galaxy. So for me, it's a given that there's life. The argument's always been, and even for science today, they're not really arguing that there's other life out there or even intelligent life. The argument is, can that life get to this planet? And if it is, are they abducting our citizens? And if they are, is there anything we can do about it? And that seems to be where everything lies these days. So people like Larry Warner are important in the fact that they're willing to tell what happened to them. And they're credible enough that, you know, they're not some crackhead that's calling in and saying, I was abducted by aliens.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Appreciate that. I do have one report coming from Colonia, British Columbia in Canada, but I'm not going to go with this story yet. I cannot until I get some more corroboration on it, but if you are in that area, if you can send me some information that may match what I'm seeing, I might be able to put this out. So if you live near the airport, just send me a fast blast. You will probably know what I'm talking about. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, what's going on, George?
Hi, good to talk with you.
My name's Hans. I'm from Imperial Beach, California.
Hey, Hans.
And I just wanted to mention that the History Channel last weekend had a thing on the Nova Scotia incident where they said they interviewed two Canada divers, and they went down and they seen the two ships locked together and the aliens on the outside of it. And they also said there was a lighthouse 10 miles from there that found a debris on the beach that was smoking and steaming. After the spaceship went into the water, he found debris that he had to give to the U.S. government.
That was that foam, I think. Was it not, Joe?
No, it was a big steel pipe on the shore by the lighthouse.
Oh, really?
Smoking,
okay.
Yeah. And he had to give that to the U.S. government, no questions asked.
Interesting. Now, did they come up with some kind of theory on what they think this was?
No, he thinks that it was something to do with some kind of fuel cell or something, but he wasn't told anything by the U.S. government. He had to give it to him, no questions asked.
All right, did he think it was an extraterrestrial craft as opposed to a military plane of some sort?
No, he says it's nothing that he's seen before, and he was an old man.
Yeah,
so.
Okay, that's a good thing. And Joe, did you ever come across something like that?
I heard about the farm, not physical wreckage. No, I mean, I heard rumors that the military may have recovered some physical records, but I didn't even hear anything about it washed up on a beach. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to find a document trail to that.
We'll do that. We'll track down that History Channel report because it didn't get much publicity.
No, and I try to keep up as much of them as I can. I don't know. I'll keep an eye out for it, too, because I'm kind of curious now.
Okay. Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I really appreciate you and Mr. Bell a lot, and your open-mindedness and your investigativeness. And I had one question for your guest and one comment on the grave.
Sure.
I don't know if you know the answer to this question, because I know that you're really studying the abductee case. I really identify with what you said about you have to be completely stupid to believe that out of the trillions of planets in the universe that we're alone, we're the only form of life. I have heard that there are 6 different known alien races that that were contact that we're that are in the process of dealing with us here on this planet, and if you knew what these six different races were, and if you could identify them.
Okay, now, but what I can tell you for sure is that we do investigate the Greys, the human-type aliens, and the reptilians. Okay. Supposedly, the Greys work for the light beams, which is a whole separate entity in itself. Then there's Charles Halls White. At first, I was kind of skeptical about these guys. I got to be honest. Recently, I've had some people, one from a Vegas casino, call me about seeing these things. Even says they can provide videotape from one of the... Now, if I can get my hands on this, don't worry, George, you'll be the first person I call. If I can get my hands on this, then maybe we can corroborate that particular type alien being here as well. And then there's another type that people describe, and I'm not sure how to really label these. They're probably some type of hybrid. Some people say it's a cross between the humans and the Greys, some between the reptilians and the Greys. No one really knows, but there does seem to be a hybrid type running around out there. Now, that's the ones that we mainly investigate and deal with. Then there's one other kind, these little short brown guys. Now, we've heard about these on about 100, 150 occasions. They say these guys actually eat humans.
Oh, my God.
Now, whether or not this is true, I have no way I can corroborate.
Sounds like a Twilight Zone movie.
Well, that's why I'm always real clear about this kind of stuff. You know, there is no way we can corroborate this. This is at best hearsay from contactees, but these 150 contactees did label these aliens the same type of alien, basically the same description, said they were very hostile towards human, and on at least half those occasions said there was human remnants present while they were there, you know, pieces and body parts. And that's all we can really say. I mean, there's no other way to corroborate. I mean, there's just from the eyewitness testimony, and that's it, but... You know, that's the ones that we deal with the most. That's what we deal with. Now, I know a lot of people say there's 56 types and 72. The only evidence I've seen so far is for the ones we've just talked about. And the most evidence there is for the reptilians, the humans, and the Greys. Those three type of aliens seem to be prominent. They seem to run back at least 10,000 years in our history, probably much further than that. And they've been with us. I mean, all you got to do is look at the Egyptian hieroglyphs or the Sumerian texts, and you'll know they've been with us for at least 6,000 years.
Something's been there. Joseph, we're out of time. I want to thank you for a great evening.
No, I appreciate it, George. I had a great time, and I appreciate the time coming on.
All right, Joe's website, and you can listen to his radio show. Just get the link at coasttocoastam.com. And I've gotten another report from Kelowna. And not enough to go with on the air, but I'll continue to follow up tomorrow. It could be nothing, could be a huge story. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbeth, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.